athletes to fight on the solid ice of the lake. Arbor nodded grimly. Still, Onranian rationalized, even with that force, they still have to ascend the rapids and get through the other defenses. As long as the Alka'alon hold the defense in force, their army will fail. Not against dragons, I pointed out. Dragons, Onranian said, a faraway look in his eye. Yes, the dragons. Well, I suppose that would do it, then. 5 dragons and a massive army? Not even the best of the Alka'alon lords could hold out against that. The audacity is breathtaking, Onranian concurred. The council lords have been sitting and observing the fight between the Gavani and the Humani when the abomination's goal is no less than destroying the closest Alka'alon citadel to his seat. Their own arrogance has caught them by surprise, and it will be their undoing. Sharul is sending his army upriver to storm the ancient lake city of Anthatiel, to destroy the Tower of Vision, the very seat of Lord Eratas. That's the only thing that makes sense. Arborn and I discussed the possibility all the way back to the castle, after we stopped so he could check in on some of his wounded rangers. He was universally respected among his fellows, I noticed, as he spoke to each wounded man in the tent, which was a high mark in his favor. I could see why Penny was attracted to him. For a humble backcountry tribal ranger, Arborn proved wise in matters of strategy, I found, as we discussed the potential ramifications of Onranian's analysis. By the time we got back to the headquarters room, we had pieced together nearly every aspect of the campaign. Sharul had fainted at Castelshah, while preparing to strike a far more powerful foe unsuspectingly. The Alka'alon were, of course, the real powers in the region. Eventually they would have intervened in the war more forcefully, I hoped. I'm sure that's what Sharul feared as well, and attacking one of the most powerful, and the one positioned to do him the most harm with a powerful surprise assault, made every kind of strategic sense. Once he defeated the Alka'alon in their own keeps, he could look down on the Humani lands with impunity. That did not bode well for either race. That was the consensus when we got back to headquarters. We explained what we had learned from Onranian to Telamon, Count Salgo, who was riding on an inspection tour, and the other commanders, and why it made strategic sense. Despite some initial skepticism, they could find no fault in our reasoning.
"Why, that's great news," Count Salgo observed.
"If they are throwing themselves at the tree folk, they aren't ravaging our countryside." "Yes, they can leave that for next year, when they can come back down that icy road in strength, without fear of penalty from the Alka'alon," Telamon countered sourly.
"If they come back at all," Salgo riposted. "You said yourselves that the Alka'alon are the masters of magic. Surely they can defeat this rabble for us?"
"Not with 5 dragons to contend with as well," Arborn pointed out. "That army would likely be smashed if the gates are tended and the defensive spellworks are maintained. But if the city is a smoking ruin when they get to the gates, they have a good chance."
"I don't see how that is our problem," Salgo shrugged. "Nor is there anything that we can do about it. This is a gift from Duin, gentlemen," he assured us.
I wasn't so sure. I had to agree with Onranian. The audacity was majestic. Turning a sandlot scrap between 2 inferior races into a full-blown war with the powers of the region was a bold move. It could not help but solidify the Alka'alon Council against him. Yet if that was inevitable, then striking a blow when they were unawares and unprepared was brilliant. It raised the stakes in the war. It also endangered one of the ancient citadels of the Alka'alon. Remembering my time in Carnaduin, I could not abide such a thing. Then I remembered something else about Carnaduin. I summoned Lady Fallowen and told her what we had figured out.
My father's realm?
She asked, her face as white as a sheet.
They dare?
She was trembling with rage as we explained the details, until even she had to agree that there was a danger.
she immediately departed to warn her folk of the threat. Onranyan had done his part to spread the word among his kindred, and soon the Alka-Alon encampment seethed with anger and expectation. They reflected the sentiment of Felawen. How dare they? The idea of a race of former trash-pickers challenging the dominion of one of the greatest of Alkan works left in the world was appalling to them. They were outraged by the mere suggestion. Meanwhile, the human troops seemed visibly relieved that they were not going to be facing the endless line of worms and goblins and trolls that had descended from the north. They seemed almost happy to go after the marauding bands that were harassing the Gilmoran countryside by preference. Those cleaning up duties were keeping them plenty busy. Fellhounds still carried their riders everywhere in the night. Manors were still under attack, and the buckler was raiding in strength. There was plenty to do, but it was manageable. What the tree folk were facing was not. Of course, I had to summon Rard by mirror and report what we'd discovered. He was beyond pleased. "The gods are with us," he said, visibly relieved in the water. "Let them break their teeth on the tree folk. We can keep the kingdom secure while their armies grind themselves against their masters." "It is not that simple, Majesty," I tried to point out. "An alliance works both ways. The Alka-Alon have assisted us in our hour of need. Now it is our turn." "What would you have us do, spellmonger?" Rard asked, amused. "If the mighty Alka-Alon cannot repel this army, then their worth in the alliance is suspect." "Against dragons, even the Alka-Alon will be challenged," I countered. "I know not how we will respond yet, Majesty, but if there is some way in which we might assist, I feel we are obligated to do so." "I disagree," the king said, shaking his head. "Protecting the heartlands of the kingdom is our highest priority." "Majesty, if we use the first and third commandos..." "No," the king said in a tone that brooked no argument. "Those are royal troops. Their job is to defend Gilmora, which is, as you've pointed out, heavily infested with goblins. They are not to go running after an army 20 times their size." I had a hard time countering that reasoning. In truth, I had no idea what we could do to assist the Alka-Alon. Throwing good men to their deaths would not do it. "Understood, Majesty," I nodded. "I will find another way, an arcane way, to help our friends." Rard seemed satisfied with that, but I was disturbed. If he didn't take the Alka-Alon alliance seriously, then soon neither would the Alka-Alon. On the other hand, he'd been right. There was little we could do against the determined, powerful army that was marching up the icy flow of the Poros toward the land of scars, the backcountry of the wild Al-Shari wilderlands. Even if we mustered every man we could, we still could not catch them. I needed more information. I felt helpless, as if I was profiting from the misfortune of a friend. When I quit the Chamber of the Mirror, I took a walk down to the townlands, to the banks of the Poros, where our men were still guarding the bridge that didn't mean anything anymore. There were snipers and goblin patrols on the other side of the river, and encampments of their hordes were scattered across the farms to the north. I was careful. I sat and I smoked a pipe while I thought about the situation. I felt trapped. What could I do about the receding army? What could I do about the dragons? What could I do about the frozen river that so many lives depended upon flowing? Rard would have me stay here and wait, protect the heartlands and see if the Alka-Alon could defend themselves. I did not see passivity as the key to this engagement. While pacifying the raiders that Shirul had intended as distraction was a worthy goal, to do so while one of the greatest of the Alka-Alon realms was destroyed seemed callous. There had to be something we could do. Something. After an hour or so of staring at the dirty ice, Lorcus joined me. He had brought a flask of spirits and a look of concern. The spirits were welcome. "Some folks are worried about you," he said, when he took a seat beside me on the bank. "This has been a tough turn for us all, but you're the one they look to. And you're perplexed, would be the right word," I supplied, packing my pipe again. I've been forbidden by my king from sending his loyal men on a suicidal mission against a superior foe, I pouted. Meanwhile, dragons are in the air, and there is precious little I can do about it.
Well, the question is, what can you do?
Stop looking at it in terms of accomplishing the singular task of stopping the army. What are you capable of? What are your resources? 100-odd war magi, I chuckled. A few hundred Alka'alon, giant-sized. My household guard, the sphere, the falcons, the magical auxiliaries, a mountain of snowstone, a bunch of magical rocks, the Kasari, good humor, wit, and wisdom, a winning smile. Ishi's tits. How can I turn any of that into anything helpful?
Good question, agreed Lorcus, lighting his pipe by cantrip and passing me his flask.
Personally, I think the Alka'alon are screwed. Dragons are an army they could defeat, perhaps, but together, even if they won, I'm not certain it would be worth winning.
If Sharul wants the city, then I don't want him to have it, I reasoned. That's what it comes down to for me. I just don't know how to get there from here.
I'd say the first step would be to figure out what the Alka'alon are doing about their incipient goblin infestation, he recommended. See if they do have a response, and offer our assistance. Even if that means pissing off the king.
Especially if that means pissing off the king, he agreed.
I wouldn't worry about that. He's facing new attacks in Gilmora. He's got bigger things to worry about. It's true he fears your indispensable position as an ambassador to the Alka'alon. This is an opportunity to demonstrate why it's indispensable, by acting independently of the crown. You think I should just go pay a call on the Alka'alon and ask them what they were planning on doing about it?
Yes, in a nutshell, he agreed with a chuckle. Offer your assistance. See what they say.
The worst that can happen is they take you up on your offer. At best, they say, no, thank you, we have this under control, and start singing like it's a festival day.
That's actually not a bad idea, I said, after sipping his flask and returning it. It was good.
Lorcus always finds the best liquor, I'd noticed.
It wouldn't take long, if we can persuade one of the emissaries to bear us by their waypoints, and we might learn something useful.
Us? Lorcus asked in surprise. You don't seem to be doing anything else useful at the moment, I observed. Go scrape up your best court finery, and tell my apprentices to do likewise. I think it's time the spellmonger paid a call on our honored allies.
Chapter 28 The Tower of Vision. As Lady Fallowen had already departed, and Lady Ithalia was leading a chase party for a band of fellhound cavalry that was harassing the countryside 20 miles west, it fell to Lady Vernon to escort us to the halls of council in Carnaduin. She had spent the last few weeks with Pentandra at our field hospital and support facility, using her magic to aid in the defense of the complex and the aid of the wounded. While there was still plenty there for her to do, she was happy to take a break from her duties and escort me and a small party to Carnaduin through the waypoints. And since we both possessed waystones, her coming to me before escorting us all was easy. As entourage, I had chosen Lorcus and my three apprentices, plus Captain Arborn. He wished to make his own report to the council and seemed certain that they would hear him. I suppose I didn't have to bring my apprentices, but they have an annoying habit of being useful. I also felt the journey would be educational, despite the drama of the moment. They had all dressed in court apparel, with the addition of 3 7-door green cloaks, with the white snowflake embroidered on the breast. To my surprise, Pentandra had presumed to invite herself along. I was pleased. I always appreciate Penny's counsel, now more than ever. She had her own perspective to add to the report, and wanted to make certain I did not screw up something this important. When I'd explained what we'd figured out about the Vanishing Army's intended target, she had been naturally horrified. She turned into a giggling schoolgirl the moment she got around Arborn, however. For a woman who studies human sexual interaction at the arcane level, Pentandra could still be gnawingly typical when it came to love. Arborn was nearly embarrassed by her flirtations until we entered the waypoint. Arriving in Carnaduin sobered everyone. The beautiful valley was no less gorgeous at this time of year, but its serenity was shattered. The peace that seemed to imbue the place a year ago was replaced by a tense watchfulness that was palpable from the moment we arrived.
"This way,"
Lady Varen indicated smoothly, and led us to one of the smaller halls, not the council chamber in the Hall of Wisdom we'd been to before.
"That room is used only for the meeting of the full council.
The Master of the Vale is seated here at the moment.
He will see you,"
she explained solemnly, as she pulled the door open.
"Ah, our Humani friends," Master Harothel said as we entered.
He was seated on a cushion in front of a number of strange-looking potted trees. He rose immediately, and then suddenly transformed. He was 6 feet tall, a bit rotund and squinty, but he had mastered the transgenic enchantment perfectly.
"That's better," he mused, brushing off the long verdant robe he'd manifested. "They're right. This is easier than looking up all the time. Oh, my. What a change in perspective. You're here about the Gavanni advance, I suppose. I'm afraid we have little further assistance to offer you, Master Menelan," he said apologetically. "All of our powers are bent to Anthatiel against the abomination. The ice makes defending her difficult now, and..."
"Begging your pardon, Master Harothel," I said with a deep bow, "we are not here to beg for aid. Indeed, we are here to offer our assistance." He looked startled.
"Your... what?"
"Our assistance in the defense of the Alcaalon, as per the terms of our alliance," I said simply. "It was my understanding that we were to offer mutual aid in this endeavor."
"Mutual aid? You're serious?"
he asked, sounding a bit condescending. "We are not wholly impotent, Master Harothel," I pointed out. "We've been fighting this enemy for 3 years now. I know not how, but there may be some part we can play."
Why, that is very generous of you,"
Harothel said sincerely.
"Isn't that just? This is very noble of you, Master Menelan, but I cannot think of anything you might do to help. Here,"
he said, and sang a quick melody. A mage map appeared, but far more fluid and detailed than any crafted by a human mage. He waved his hands until it showed the poros, a gleaming white serpent cutting through the greening lands of western Alshar, until it came to the horde. Then the ice turned black, as Dara had reported. The column of goblins went on for miles and miles, with dozens of siege worms pulling massive wains, or huge loads, across the gleaming ice on long, trailing platforms. Half-assembled siege engines, on great wheels, were pulled by worms and pushed by trolls. There were whole centuries of those foul beasts, each with a tree trunk for a club and a huge bronze shield strapped to their back. Some wore helmets of steel or bronze as well. The goblin infantry seemed to go on forever. The Gavanni were struggling with their iron cleats, but every few dozen rows there was a hobgoblin with a whip that kept the straggling to a minimum. Many wore cloaks made from captured blankets, sheepskin or cowhide, and none of them looked particularly happy. As the scene zoomed along, the map halted on the image of a large redoubt atop the back of one of the worms. While there were several of these portable castles, this one was particularly stoutly built and heavily ornamented with the tokens and signs of the dead god. It was a frightening vista, seen that way. The goblins were marching relentlessly across the ice, farther and farther upriver. There was no telltale plume of dust, as an army treading a road inevitably kicks up. But the path of the army was clear to see. In its wake, it left a filthy sheen of debris and jetsam, feces and urine, vomit and blood and the occasional Gavanni corpse, all mixed into the surface of the ice by countless pairs of iron cleats.
"This is what approaches the Tower of Vision," Harothel announced as we watched in dismay, "in addition to a number of dragons."
He stated it matter-of-factly, as if he wasn't talking about mammoth castle-destroying killing machines.
"And Thatiel seems to be severely challenged. If they cannot stop one, the other, or both."
"And Thatiel is doomed,"
Arborn said bluntly. I felt Penny shiver next to me.
I know not the full extent of the mastery of your kindred, Rhaer Harothel, but I cannot foresee a victory here, not unless the might of all the elders is united and dedicated to this purpose. What aid that can be sent is being sent, Harothel assured us, but there are limits to what we can do this quickly. If the Gavanni keep moving at this pace, they will be at the edge of the Land of Scars in 4, perhaps as many as 6 days. They will have to make that difficult journey through the broken country, ascending the escarpment, until they come to the secluded valley lands near the source of the Poros. That journey could take anywhere from 3 to 5 days, depending on how adept they are at scaling the rise. Once they achieve this waterfall, he said, indicating a space on the mage map, all the natural defences are behind them. All that stands between them and Thatiel is the great gate that seals the lake valley. The great gate that is frozen open at the moment, he added worriedly. It is well guarded, but it cannot be closed while this enchantment stands.
So what recourse does Lord Eratas have? Demanded Arborn. He must stand and fight, or abandon the city.
Both courses of action are being considered, the Master of the Vale said. Lord Latharan has sent some Alcan warriors to assist in the defence, but he looks to his own skies with concern. Should the abomination find Aenas Yatharel undefended, it could prove disastrous for more than one realm.
King Rad is similarly poorly disposed of the idea of sending aid, for much the same reason, I agreed. Yet I find I cannot abide the thought of sitting idly by while Sharul gets his way.
Yet what could you do, Master Menelan, that an Alka Alon elder could not? He challenged. While your pledge of assistance is appreciated, my boy, I cannot think of a way in which you can stall this battle, or win it. You have developed some impressive and surprising capabilities in a short time, but I cannot imagine how they could prove helpful.
I could tell he was straining courtesy not to sound condescending. My people leapt to my aid before I could speak.
Oh, you don't know Master Menelan very well then, sire, Lorca said, unbidden from behind me. The man excels at finding ways to prove helpful. A deep and cunning mind he has, and subtle beyond the ken of most magi.
He is a wise and determined leader, agreed Arborn. He is loyal, courteous, and brave. He is indeed cunning, he said almost grudgingly. That was high praise from a Kasari ranger. If there is a way to relieve Anthatiel, he will surely find it.
That was more confidence in me than I felt, certainly. Of course, Pentandra could not keep quiet.
If nothing else, Master Harothel, we could coordinate our efforts, she proposed.
Master Menelan has many magi at his disposal. Human magi, she said, almost apologetically. But they are skilled at their craft and enriched by Irionite. Surely we can be of some assistance.
My dear, it is doubtful that Lord Eratas would even accept your assistance, though there were dragons at his doorstep. He has little love of humani, the kindly Alcan reminded us. Indeed, he is one of your biggest opponents on the council.
Be that as it may, I dismissed. We would not have it said that Humani stood by and watched helplessly while Anthatiel is assaulted. If Lord Eratas doesn't want to thank us for our help, we'll just do it without his gratitude.
You are free to spend your lives as you wish, shrugged the Alcan Lord. I will not discourage such a noble and courageous gesture. We will summon you if we feel there is some role you might play in the defense of Anthatiel.
And Master Menelan, he said, reaching out and touching my arm. Your offer is, indeed, truly appreciated. Do not mistake reluctance to exploit it for contempt.
I just honestly do not know what can be done, he said, with a rare and somber note of despair in his voice.
We headed back to the waypoint with a feeling of helpless dread wrapped around our party like a cloak.
Lorcas and Tyndall tried to trade a few jokes, but no one felt like laughing.
Lady Verin was nearly silent as she escorted us. The most mysterious of the 3 Alcan emissaries halted when we arrived at the spot in the plaza.
I shall take the rest of you back to where you wish, she proposed, but my sister Falowen approaches and wishes to speak with Master Menelan. Alone.
Me? Why? I demanded. She did not say, admitted Verin. Where shall I take you? Back to Gilmora? Without a specific waypoint there, it will be difficult to...
No. Take them back to Sevendor instead, I decided. I turned to Tyndall. Have notice sent out to our allies that I am recruiting men for an especially dangerous mission. High pay, high danger. Combat veterans only, I stressed. This is no campaign for a new soldier.
How many, Master?
Tyndall asked, thoughtfully. As many as we can raise. Have all interested parties appear on the Sevendor Commons 4 days hence.
Master?
What are you planning on doing with them? He asked. I don't know yet, I confessed, but Rad denied me use of royal troops. He did not forbid me from raising my own. Whatever maneuver we attempt, I prefer to have men I've hired and that I can trust to execute it.
You can add my men to yours,
pledged Arborn. I will send word to Kassar and see how many volunteers I can raise as well. Your men are not soldiers, I protested.
We are hunters, he agreed, and now we hunt Gavanni. You will need our skills if I guess correctly what you will propose.
What I'll propose? I haven't the faintest idea what to do now.
Yes, you do, the big man said, shaking his head. You have already begun to form a plan, my friend Minolin. When it is ready, so will be the Kassari.
I couldn't really argue with that. Unfortunately, his confidence in me made me feel that much more pressure. Pentandra, too, was looking at me expectantly. The honest truth was that I had very little idea how to proceed, and felt that their confidence in me was misplaced. But I couldn't say that. One of the curses of power is the responsibility of performing to the expectations of those who look up to you, and I wasn't feeling particularly inspired. Panicked, yes, but inspired? I waved at them as they disappeared in the light. A few moments later, Lady Fallowen appeared in her large form and dressed in her battle armor.
Master Minolin, she said, bowing, thank you for indulging me. When I heard you were here, I was confused, until I heard why. Your offer was nobly delivered, she said with a bow.
It is my pleasure, my lady. What can I do for you?
My father is hard at work, preparing to defend our beautiful city. He is confident of his victory, and while he has asked his fellow elders for assistance, he feels pride in the city's defences, no matter that they are compromised.
I understand. But what can I do?
Please, come talk to him,
she begged.
I have told him the reality of what he faces, and yet he ignores me. I have pleaded with him to evacuate the city, but he insists and Flatiel will not fall while he is there to defend it. I speak to him of dragons, and he sends me away. Help me, Mage Lord Minolin, she pleaded. If he does not evacuate, thousands will die.
I blinked. This was not what I expected. I can spare a little time, I agreed reluctantly. But then if I was planning on trying to rescue the city, I might as well see the real estate I might be dying to preserve. I'll go with you, I nodded, gripping Blizzard tightly. She looked desperate and relieved at the same time, and immediately began the song that opened the Alcan waypoints. Our bodies were transported across 1,000 miles in the space of 3 heartbeats. When we arrived, while I fought with the inevitable bout of nausea, I felt the temperature drop dramatically. I felt cold wind on my face, colder than the early spring weather I'd become accustomed to. The stones under my feet were dark grey, as were the graceful columns and delicate railing ahead of me. I put out a hand to steady myself upon it, and immediately regretted it. We were up high, at least 30 stories, and the ground swam below me dangerously. I felt Lady Fallowen's slender but strong hand on my arm to steady me.
Easy, she urged quietly. We stand in the Tower of Vision, tallest spire in Anthatiel, the seat of Lord Eritas, Rear of the Lake City. My father.
So where is the little guy?
I asked, finally catching my breath.
I have summoned him. He will be here momentarily.
It's beautiful, I said simply.
Beautiful didn't begin to describe it, but that's the best word that human language has contrived. And Thatiel was a cunningly, exquisitely crafted city of stone, of surpassing beauty. The island in the middle of the huge lake had been completely covered by a maze of domes, spires, vaults, and citadels, each of a particular design and crafted of surpassing loveliness. The skyline had the architectural beauty of a field of wildflowers graven in stone. But the city's purposeful beauty was nearly lost in the shadow of the grand vista around it. The Tower of Vision was aptly named. The gallery opened on a spectacular view of the lake, now frozen to bitter whiteness, with stark grey cliffs miles in the distance. We were facing east, toward the one true rent in the steep-sided lake valley. Two severe edifices of solid rock framed the beautifully wild country beyond like a painting. At the bottom of the cliffs were two mighty battlements made of the same stone. They had to be at least 10 stories high themselves, but they were dwarfed by the cliffs to which they were attached. From each, running halfway up the length of the battlements, were two massive gates, thick enough that I could see the individual spars of the gate 2 miles away. They extended into the lake below, and were broad enough to allow a ship of great size to pass, if one should chance by. But they were both frozen in place, useless. As majestic as the landscape view and the gates were, the real attraction were the 5 great waterfalls that tumbled over the cliffs periodically around the great grey bowl. The lake they splashed into, in happier times, was at least 20 square miles, the parts that I could see. The waterfalls had not been affected by the spell and continued to spill, but the moment the water touched the surface, it froze. Huge columns of ice were creeping upward from the frozen lake surface. It would have been impressive enough as liquid, but as ice, it was a magnificent, brilliant view. "My home once," she said wistfully. "I grew up on an estate on the northeastern shore. I saw the city lights every night as I went to sleep. I loved the years I spent here during my education. I left after an argument with my father. And Thatiel is the pride of my kindred in this realm. It has endured for over 1,000 years. It should endure 1,000 more, if we can stop this army." "That is not your concern, daughter," Lord Eritas said sternly from behind us. "And Thatiel is mine to protect. You gave up that responsibility when you left. I've already told you that I will not cede my city before the first blow has fallen. Why have you returned?" "I thought Master Minolan might convince you," she said, taking my arm. "He, more than anyone, knows what we face if we remain here." The old Alcan lord looked at me harshly. "And you would have me flee?" "Me?" I asked. "No, but I would evacuate your non-combatants." Fallowen looked at me as if I'd betrayed her. I shook her off. "Look, your daughter asked me to speak to you, and I will. But I keep my own counsel. She is correct. The force arrayed against you is vast, strong, and potent. They're also driven in ways I can only imagine, with the displeasure of Sherald to keep their feet moving. Your best natural defense has been rendered useless. They have to get through the wilderness, I know. But they're equipped for that. So, your strategic choices are to run or fight, because I foresee that negotiations will not be productive. Sending your non-combatants to safety makes sense. Running away yourself? With whatever force you possess? That I do not, counsel. Sherul must be beaten, and I've risked my own life again and again to do so. I am not happy he's turned his attention to you, I promised, but you have more might to meet him with than I ever will. If anyone can turn the tide in this war, it's Anthatiel. Send for your allies.
I have, he said flatly.
Annas Yartharel sent a few warriors. None of the other kindreds have done as much. Then Anthatiel must fight alone. But fight it must.
Master Minolan, that is not what I brought you here to say, Thalowin said crossly.
That is my counsel, I shrugged. As bold a move as this is on Sherul's part, I think he's drastically miscalculated. Whatever element of surprise he had is now lost. But while you don't have much time, and your defenses are compromised, you still have enough time to mount a credible response.
"'And how would the spellmonger defend our realm in my place?' Eritaz asked, amused. "'I think he was pleased with how I had shaken off his daughter. "'Me. I would contest every foot of land from the escarpment to your gate,' I suggested. "'Send out your... whatever it is you people call your rangers. "'Set traps. Sabotage them. Raid them. "'They are expecting you to sit back and serenely rebuke them arcanely.' Show them that you can defend your territory as tenaciously as any Gavani tribe. And then, once they finally made it to your gate, make it the damnedest fight they've ever imagined. You have thousands of years of history to call upon, and song spells I can't even imagine. Use them to inflict pain on them, pour forth what powers of destruction you have at your disposal, and make them fear your might. This is counsel I can heed. He said, with a hint of a smile.
Father, Master Minolin, will you not see reason? The Gavani will overwhelm you here. The gates are frozen open. The lake is frozen solid. The Spectra no longer protect us. They'll be able to walk right up to your chamber door.
They will not get here unchallenged, he resolved.
This Humani shape, he said uncomfortably. Does it make you stronger? It is. It does, she admitted. Stronger, taller, faster in some ways. The limitations on intellect are annoying, she pointed out, and the emotion is distracting, but there is no denying that the Humani bodies are very strong.
Strong enough to fight the Gavani, tooth and claw? He asked, appraisingly.
That has been my duty for 3 years now, Lord Eritas, I nodded.
If we evacuate the non-combatants, we will have fewer than 6,000 Alcan to defend the citadel, he said quietly. Only half of those can be considered trained warriors. If I heed your counsel, spellmonger, I will need every advantage. The council relaxed the proscription on transgenic enchantments. If my people transform themselves into this, he said, wrinkling what little nose his diminutive form possessed, then we would possess considerable advantage on the ice.
More than they anticipate, I agreed, a little reluctantly. Humani form gives you significant advantage in hand-to-hand combat, with the song spells to help. Well, Oranyan seems pretty fond of skewering Gavani with his great sword, and he came through the Battle of Gavard without a scratch.
Then I shall procure one. And whatever other accoutrements that I need to fit that form, for I will wear whatever form is necessary to defend my city and bear appropriate arms to do so. I will not let that filth sully the sacred island my sires built out of the naked rock, he said, as defiantly as any hill chieftain.
But what of the non-combatants? Women and children, I asked. Surely they can be transported to safety. Master Arathel could take some. There are other refuges.
If we are to make a defense, then I would do so without that worry, he agreed.
He turned to his much taller daughter.
Will this pacify you then, Fallowin? For the moment, she said after a moment's hesitation. Father, I do not wish to see you throw your life away in a pointless battle.
Fighting for one's home is not pointless, he said solemnly. Curse me for a barbarian, Humani, but I shall not be driven from my lands by an abomination. I would rather perish in defense than concede before a blow has been struck.
I see the wisdom in that, she agreed sullenly, but I wish it were not so.
I wish this whole situation wasn't so, but the gods don't seem to listen to me, I grunted. If this is settled, I'd like to get back to my own part in the war. My king is being stubborn, and I have to convince him that sitting on his hands instead of seizing the initiative is the wiser course of action.
May the gods speed your journey then, spellmonger, Lord Eritas said, nodding.
He held up the jewel I gave him, still on its silver chain.
I have used this several times. It has proven very useful. I never expected it might.
So too has counsel come from the unlikeliest of quarters, and perhaps it proves useful, too.
Farewell, spellmonger, he said, and sang a little tune.
Before I could say or do anything, I was being hurtled into the magical aperture,
or whatever it was, of the Alcan waypoint. I panicked, for 3 heartbeats. Then I was in Sevendor, high atop Matin's helm, Lesgathiel towering above me as I lay face down in the sweet grass in the middle of an Alcan garden. A pity it was raining so much. I'm sure Lord Eritas would be amused. I wasn't. I didn't see anyone around, so I brushed as much mud off my armor as I could, picked Blizzard up off the ground, and started the long walk down the hill. It was good to be home, even for a short time. I played with the babies and puppies and properly greeted my wife, had my armor repaired and polished, and made reports to important people about the important things they needed to be aware of to make important decisions. The news was simple. The Alca alone would stand and fight. Pentandra was ecstatic. Telemann was hopeful. Rard could care less. He wanted to talk about the upcoming royal wedding. Me, I was frustrated. I felt helpless in the face of events. There wasn't even a really compelling reason for me to journey back to Gilmora. All of this supposed power at my disposal, and I couldn't do anything with it. How could I help Eritas and Glorious Anthatiel against the Gavanni? Against dragons? Forewarning him may have helped a little, and undoubtedly saved lives. But how could we turn this to an advantage? I asked myself, and everyone around me with an opinion, for suggestions. I got a few. None of them were particularly helpful. But I couldn't give up. There had to be a way to influence events, to save the Alcan city and destroy as much of Sharul's army as we could. Sitting south of the Poros and mopping up goblin messes was not the most prudent use of our resources. I had more Irionite than the later Majocracy. I had a pouch full of uniquely magical stones that could do miraculous things. There had to be a way to use them to change the situation somehow. Figuring out how occupied my thoughts constantly. I stumbled through 100 different and equally unlikely scenarios. The problem was the army was moving too fast and was too big. Every hour I delayed, the Gavanni went further up the river. As much power as I had, I was impotent to stop it. That was what was frustrating me. I couldn't sleep. After Alia gave me one hell of a welcome home from battle reunion, I could not force myself to sleep. My mind would not turn loose of the problem. I stared at the ceiling until I got sick of it. I got up without waking my wife, summoned a dim mage light, and went for a walk. Nowhere in particular. I just wanted to be elsewhere. My bedroom is not where I want to be pensive and contemplative. It sets a poor precedent. I slipped on my slippers and started walking. I found myself in the chapel. I almost passed by like I usually did, heading for the kitchens. For some reason I stopped and went in. I spellbound the door to keep from being disturbed. It was empty, of course, at this hour. The priestess would not be in to sing the Lords of Dawn for hours. I lit a candle in front of the altar and tried to figure out to which god I wanted to talk. Prayer wasn't an exercise I indulged in frequently. Apart from the usual celebrations and festivals, my religious life was minimal. I'd had the chapel built as a boon to the folk of the castle, and to give Sister Bemia and the other clergy a place to hold sacred rites and instruction. There were idols to a great many gods there, ready to be placed on the all-purpose altar. I looked at their sculpted faces, the expressions of humanity, divinity, and serenity that the artist had thought best captured the essence of the divine. With whom would it be best to consult for this particular problem, I wondered. Luin, the lawgiver? I doubt Shurul would respond to a court summons. Duin, the destroyer? Kill them all was easy to say, but Duin's strengths were naked force and valiance. I didn't see how that could be helpful here. Huin, the Lord of Agriculture, wasn't helpful. I couldn't plant my way out of this problem. Similarly, I didn't see how the youngest brother of the four, Kulin, could help. The patron of horse thieves and lone travellers was unlikely to offer advice that didn't involve horses or roadways. Their uncle, the sea god, wasn't going to be much help for similar reasons. Trig was for marriage and family. Orvatas Skyfather was for celestial matters and sheep. Harris could recommend a good inn, but was useless for military endeavours,
and Ishii could get me laid. None of them had any particular bearing on the subject, save Duin, and I already knew how to hit things really hard and die bravely in battle. Why wasn't there a god of brilliant, last-minute solutions? Would that just be too convenient for the universe? Of the major Narasi pantheon I was personally familiar with among the idols, that left Brigga the Bright One. One of three sisters to the four brothers, goddess of fire, magic, poetry, wisdom, smithcraft, defensive warfare, crafts, archery, childbirth, vengeance, and baking. That last is why I knew her so well. My father is a successful baker, and he holds a prestigious lay position among the temples of Brigga as a result. I'd worshipped the Bright One and learned her simple rites as a child. Her fiery arrows kept the nightmares at bay. Her warmth encouraged the yeast to grow. Her fire baked the bread. Her hearth was the center of the world. Of course, as I got older, I avoided lessons that didn't have to do with magic, and avoided boring services unless there was a girl involved. Fire was a naturally occurring alchemical phenomenon that, with mage sight, could be seen as the expression of oxidation and plasmatic state that it was. No theological constructs required. I developed the kind of healthy skepticism the young produce to give my studies additional meaning. I snickered at the religious. My personal religion was comfortably buried, until I got to Faris. There are no atheists in shield walls, is a popular saying amongst war brothers, and while I performed the rites of Duin with my fellows in war, I rediscovered Brigga in those dark times, when I needed a mother's solace, but was 1,000 miles away from my own. After the war, I lapsed back into practical agnosticism. Then I had invoked her again, during Manalion's birth, and accidentally created the snowstone that was now the basis of my fortune and power. That had been a time of high crisis, more so than any moment in the jungle, and she had come through for me. So in a lot of ways, I suppose I felt like I owed her, and there was every chance that praying to her might be useful in some arcane way. She was the goddess of wisdom, after all, and her folk tales were filled with her clever strategies, many of which involved baking or forging something ingenious. Maybe she would send me a dream that would answer all my problems. The more I thought about it, the better it sounded. I took her idol down and prepared the altar, as my father had taught me. Candles, incense, water, salt, flour. I lit the candles and incense and began the rite. The old simple ritual came back to me with fond, if impatient, memories from my childhood. I remembered doing this every day for months, praying to Our Lady of Rapid Oxidation to make the girls like me. I forget now why I stopped. I suppose it worked. I closed my eyes and said the ritual invocation, a simple poem, 4 stanzas long, that praised the Bright One's presence in every flame, her ability to cleanse and destroy, her devotion to protect and nourish, her creative passion at invention and wisdom. I invoked her, inviting her to be here in the chapel with me, to hear my prayers and accept my offerings, to bless me with her grace and, "That's enough already," a strong female voice commanded me. I opened up my eyes abruptly. There was a woman there, very attractively slender, yet with very womanly curves. She was wearing a bright red sideless surcoat with a bright orange chemise and a mantle of grey. Her hair spilled down her back like an advancing forest fire, and was just as scarlet. You could cut cheese with her cheekbones, they were so high and sharp, as was her forehead. Her eyes were bright green, preternaturally so, and her hands were long and narrow.
I'm here, you can stop the invocation. I swear to me, my priests are so long-winded.
I panicked. There wasn't supposed to be anyone in the tiny chapel, and it had been empty when I had come in. I summoned Twilight to my hand with a whisper. I felt a lot more secure with a magical blade eternally at my disposal, thanks to the Pocket Stone's enchantment.
"Who the hells are you?" I demanded, startled.
I had 3 spells ready to lob with a thought.
"Mother uses female assassins almost exclusively,"
my mind chose to recall.
"The flame that burneth bright, the Bright One, or, I love this one, Our Lady of Rapid Oxidation." cute.
Who?
I'm Brigger, you idiot, and you just asked me to be here, and it's about time. You should have done this months ago. We may be too late as it is, but no matter.
She glanced at Twilight, quivering 6 inches from her throat. She didn't seem in the least concerned. Her quick green eyes darted at the point of the blade and back.
Is that a magical sword in your hand? Or am I showing too much cleavage?
Chapter 29 Divine Intervention.
I beg your pardon, I asked, confused. I'm Brigger, goddess of fire, Narasi Pantheon. You just said a prayer and invoked me at an altar using all the approved prayers.
I've done this before, I countered warily, my blade unwavering. Okay, maybe it wavered a little bit. I was out of my depth here. I've never had a gorgeous redhead appear before. If I had, I would have been a damn sight more religious growing up.
You are so charming, she said flatly.
You never tried it surrounded by... what do you call it?
Snowstone, I replied. Good point. So low magic resistance and... there are gods popping into existence?
We're already in existence, she said, shaking her head. You just invited me to manifest.
The priestess does that every day, I countered.
She's not the one I wanted to talk to, she riposted.
You are, Minolin the spellmonger. We have a great deal to discuss and only a short time to do so, even here where it is relatively easy to manifest.
Why would a goddess, assuming you are one, want to talk to me? I'm one of the least religious people I know.
You think I, of all entities, don't know that?
She shot back. A couple of lousy prayers, if I'm lucky. I never hear from you, and then suddenly you're begging for my intercession with the birth of your son. I lowered my blade, quite involuntarily.
No one knew that, except me.
And apparently the goddess standing before me.
Sorry,
I said sheepishly, making Twilight vanish back into the ring. You're my first divine encounter.
I know,
she repeated.
So let's make it count, shall we?
You were going to ask for my aid or intervention in the goblin invasion?
Yes, that was the focus of my appeal, I said self-consciously. I know it's not exactly your usual area.
You'd be surprised,
she said, rolling her eyes. I'm one of those unfortunate divinities who get stuck with a whole bunch of mildly related spheres of influence. That's what happens when a primordial elemental deity gets civilized. Suddenly I go from the fiery avenger of the innocent on the steps to being lauded for baking and smithing. So, yes, I'm probably the best divinity for this particular crisis.
All right,
I said, accepting her expertise in the matter. I felt drunk. I was bantering with a goddess.
So, what should I do, then?
I can't just tell you that,
she admitted. Not precisely, at any rate. Divine intervention isn't going to make that goblin army or those dragons just suddenly disappear, I'm afraid. It doesn't work like that. But that doesn't mean I can't be of assistance. I can give you counsel.
Making the army disappear would be more useful, I pointed out.
I said I can't. For one thing, it's protected too powerfully. Shurul might not be divine in the traditional human sense, but that doesn't mean he isn't as powerful as a forest fire. It's complicated. But as for your main question, yes, they need to be stopped, and I don't see anyone else around who can do that.
What makes you think I can do it?
I'm not positive that you will, but there is definitely the possibility that you can.
That's not the sort of absolute certainty one expects from a goddess, I pointed out. I was trying to be diplomatic. The whole situation was passing strange.
That's the most I can give you, she promised.
Minolin, the consequences of Shurul taking Anthatiel would be disastrous. For your people and the Elka Alon.
In military terms, at the very least it will add years, even decades, to the war. In arcane terms, it will allow Shurul to produce a second, albeit weaker, focus of power in the Mindans, one with resources you cannot even fathom now. And in political terms,
It would tremendously upset the balance of power on the Alka-Elon Council.
I understand all that, I said, as respectfully as possible. He needs to be stopped. What I need to know is how.
That is the trick, isn't it?
She said with a slightly guilty look. Can a goddess appear uncertain of herself? Brigga seemed to be. It wasn't exactly inspiring my confidence in the divine.
Tactically speaking, your two options are intervention and pursuit, but just pouring troops into the battle isn't going to overwhelm that army. You're going to have to use cunning and guile.
You think? I asked sarcastically. I figured out as much on my own. And misdirection, obfuscation and subterfuge, not to mention some classy spell-casting. But how? I thought of just transporting more troops there from Sevendor, as I did for the battle at Cambrian, but
it would be difficult and ultimately unhelpful, she said, shaking her head. The issue isn't just numbers. It's power.
It's always about power, I sighed, my shoulders sagging.
You're catching on, she smiled knowingly.
It is indeed always about power.
Let me impart some wisdom of a cosmic nature upon you, Minolin. As much as the perquisites and trappings of power allure, the fact is that the weight of responsibility that comes with it usually makes those supposed privileges a very poor consolation.
That's something else I've figured out on my own, I said sourly.
I know,
she said sympathetically.
Everyone who finds themselves with power does. The achievement of the goal is almost never worth the effort. However, she continued, that does not mean that you can just walk away, either. You are where you are because of who you are and what you will do.
That doesn't mean it's sufficient, I grumbled. You're telling me?
Your people call me a goddess and expect wonders and miracles and ascribe to me all sorts of incredible gifts. The human mind for religious imagination is truly profound. However, the responsibilities that come with those gifts are oppressive, but I cannot walk away either.
So what can I do? I pleaded. It's about power, but the fact is that I don't have enough.
You do, she soothed. You just need to find a way to express it. Consider a magical metaphor. Once you have mastered the ability to manifest arcane power, in order to make it useful, you have to channel and shape that power through the use of runes, sigils, and other symbolic expressions of intent, will, and desire.
You do have tremendous power, Minolin, she said, nodding toward the sphere that bobbed obediently behind me.
Enough so that I was able to incarnate on your will and desire alone. Your problem is that you need to find a way to express that power in a useful way.
All right, I conceded, even if I do have the capacity to fight this army. The question remains how I express that power, hence my troubled excursion into religion.
Prayer is indeed the last refuge of the desperate, she giggled. The key to discovering your solution lies in understanding the nature of victory. In this case, there is little hope that the army's advance up the Poros can be stopped. They will reach Anthatiel, not unmolested, but there is little doubt that they will be able to scale the escarpment and drive their way into the Vale.
Couldn't you arrange for an earthquake or something?
That region is geologically stable, she said, shaking her head, and that's not exactly the style of a fire goddess.
Then what about a forest fire? I asked lamely.
In early spring, during the rainy season, when they're standing on ice that can't be burnt?
She asked. Fair point.
Wait, can't you melt the ice under their feet?
I asked, wondering why I hadn't thought of it before.
It won't work, she said, shaking her head. Sherul himself is fueling that spell.
It takes a massive, almost unthinkable amount of power, but then he has an unthinkable amount of power. It takes me a lot of power just to remain incarnate, even here, where it's easy. Only the power of your need is sufficient to keep me here. Trying to work directly against his magic would be futile, even for me.
She looked sad and frustrated over that,
and just a little pouty.
"Come now. You're a powerful goddess,"
I encouraged her. "You're the bright one. You created the snowstone. That's pretty impressive." I was trying to